It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Across the world, thousands of species of insects contribute to people's diets. Some are delicacies, and we discuss insects as protein and whether you're on board. Call in with questions and comments on eating bugs, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have May Walraven, general manager of biotech firm InnovaFeed North America, based in France. This is an insect producer for animal and plant nutrition with construction of a black soldier fly production facility underway in Decatur, Illinois. May, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thank you for having me.
We also have Valerie Stoll with us, a UW-Madison faculty associate and research scientist, president of MITI, which stands for Mission to Improve Global Health Through Innovation. Valerie, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited we're covering this topic.
Yes, indeed. And Valerie, let's dig in right away. You've studied the consumption of insects in Zambia and other countries. Is there more of an appeal for bugs in other parts of the world compared to eating them here in the States?
Well, certainly. I mean, food culture runs deep, and we are all most prone to like and eat the things we grew up eating. And insects are a part of traditional cuisines and diets around the world. About 2 billion people live in places where insects are consumed by at least some group of the population. And that's just not the case in American cuisine, but I do think trends can change, and trends can change quickly. And as our other guest knows, insects may really enter the American diet through the feed avenue, but they are certainly an important part of the diet across the globe. And if we're having an adverse response, it's just a bias that we have based on what we're used to.
I do want to just probe a little bit more here, because you mentioned, you know, how much food has such a role in cultural and social identity. I think of the all-American hot dog, for instance, goes with, you know, baseball and cookouts and apple pie. You know, what associations do you think that we make with insects here in the West?
Yeah, I certainly think there's this ick factor that a lot of Americans in particular have when it comes to thinking about insects as food. And part of that is justified. I mean, we know that some insects are vectors of disease and they do appear on things that are rotting or infected. But in reality, the majority of insects and thousands of species that are known to be edible and have been documented are totally healthy and beneficial for people to be eating. But we do have to overcome that initial response that we may have. But if you think about food traditions, I mean, I didn't grow up eating frog legs, so that disgusts me. For some people, a lobster is also not very appealing. But for others, it's a delicacy and something that you absolutely want on your plate. So part of it is exposure, you know, just being exposed to more food types and insects and learning to think about them differently, which takes time and experience.
And May, your company, InnovaFeed, based in Paris, is building this insect production facility in Illinois. Marketing for black soldier fly is you know, fisheries and aquaculture. Is that a better avenue for you rather than human consumption? Why operate in the U.S.?
So the reason we're operating in the U.S. is because there's a lot of byproducts from the agricultural industry which we can use to feed our insects. And for us, the whole purpose of growing insects and reinserting them into food chains is because they're kind of nature's super upcycler. And so we can use a lot of byproducts that are considered waste and feed our insects to then generate very high quality nutrients, so very high quality protein, but also natural oils, and then feed them to animals, into aquaculture, into swine, poultry, livestock, and create a more sustainable food chain for tomorrow. So for us, the U.S. is very interesting from a production perspective. And then we think we'll be addressing a global market when it comes to animal nutrition, because we will be facing protein deficiencies in the future. The FAO has announced that by 2050, we'll be facing a 30 to 40 million protein deficiency. So these are the challenges that we're trying to tackle.
I wonder, in these animal feed products, May, is the insect protein supplementing other protein in the products, or is it replacing or taking the place of another protein that was found in the products?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
If we take the example of aquaculture, for instance, we feed salmon, we feed shrimp with insect protein, and you could say that we're replacing fish meal, which is basically fish powder. They use wild caught fish, so a lot of small fish that are caught off the coast of Peru, of Chile, and then they use that fish to feed larger fish that we like to see on our table. The problem with that is that the fisheries at this stage are pretty much emptying the oceans of the smaller fish, and hence you see entire ecosystems that are collapsing. So with insect protein, we can replace that marine resource and avoid a lot of those that impact from fisheries. However, if you look at the growth of aquaculture today, it's growing at a 6 to 7% rate globally. And so really, at the moment, we're more sponsoring the growth than fully replacing fish meal. But we know we'll always need some part of fish meal. So it's a way to protect marine resources in the future as we need to produce more food for a growing population.
May Walraven with us, General Manager of Innova Feed North America. We have Valerie Stull with us as President of the Mission to Improve Global Health Through Innovation, talking about insects as food for people, animals, in aquaculture. You can join along the way here, 800-642-1234. Jeanette calling from Warren, Illinois. Hi, Jeanette. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I'd just like to let folks know that we go after the invasive Japanese beetles that are on our plants. They're not the ones that look like ladybugs. They're the ones that are shiny, burgundy, with five white spots on their abdomen. And since their natural response to us trying to catch them is to fall off the grapes or the raspberries, we take a simple funnel and a Gatorade bottle or something like that, hold that underneath and tap the leaves. The insects fall into those. And we will either pop them into the refrigerator for a little while to slow them down or stun them. And then when we want to make use of them, we take them out, shake the bottle as we're headed there. The rattling sound of the insects that are still quite alive, but slower, attracts our chickens. And we've got about 10 hens. Our chickens come running because they know that they're getting a treat, just like some of the garden scraps. They come running. And since they're 40% protein, we're getting rid of an invasive pest. And our chickens are getting some extra food that they love.
Oh, Jeanette, thank you for walking us through this life cycle of what you do there. I want both of you, May and Valerie, here to comment on that. Valerie, you first.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love these stories and these anecdotes of how people are thinking about insects differently. And insects are a natural part of a chicken's diet. So I'm not surprised that your chickens are very excited about that. And it's pretty innovative that you were able to collect them in that way. I will say that Japanese beetles and many beetles are also edible. And in other parts of the world, people do consume them or the larvae of the beetles as a really great source of protein and fatty acids. So it's great to see them used here for chickens. That's fantastic.
May, what are your insights on the Japanese beetle as chicken treats?
Well, I think, thank you, Jeanette, for this this story, because I think it illustrates so perfectly how insects introduce circularity. So you're taking basically what was a problem with the invasive Japanese beetle species and turning it into a solution where you're bringing treats to your chicken. So I think it's such a perfect way to illustrate why insects have a pivotal role in the food chain and why it makes sense to reintroduce them into our own food chains. And it is such a natural source of incredible nutrients that at the moment we're kind of bypassing into our diets, and you see it from the chickens' reaction. They love it.
May Walraven is with a biotech insect producer that's building an insect protein farm in Illinois. Valerie Stull is a UW-Madison research scientist studying the impacts of eating and farming insects across the world. Call in with your questions and comments about insect agriculture, raising bugs for people to eat in particular, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the global market for insect protein and the effects on sustainable food systems. Call in with your questions and comments about healthy bugs to eat, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. May Walraven is here with the insect protein biotech firm InnovaFeed North America, and Valerie Stull, president of the research collaborative MITEI that works on issues related to nutritional and environmental benefits of insect consumption. Let's take another call, Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom. What would you like to bring up?
I recently discovered that you are supposed to have older people need 80 grams of protein a day, plus exercise to keep your muscle mass from deteriorating and to keep from falling.
Take another call, Tom.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tom, I think I hear an echo in the background. Valerie, I'm wondering, I think I hear what Tom is getting at, that, you know, as older people are needing more protein, can insect protein help in that respect?
Absolutely. I mean, insects are an exceptional source of bioavailable protein, meaning that it's protein that your body can easily digest. It's comparable to protein from other animal sources like beef or eggs or chicken. If you use a dried or powdered cricket protein powder, for example, you can get about 13 grams of protein in just 2 tablespoons, which you could add to your bread or your smoothies in the morning. And it's going to have all the essential amino acids that you need for human nutrition, those that you have to get in your diet and your body can't synthesize. So insect protein is a really great option for supplementing protein or supplanting other sources of protein in the diet, particularly because of its nutritional quality as well as the environmental benefits that we've been talking about in terms of insects being a great recycling mechanism in our food system. And also, they simply are more efficient at converting food into feed than conventional animal sources, and they emit fewer greenhouse gases in the process of being farmed.
Can you talk a bit more about the uptake there on things like in the form of powder or in the form of protein bars or cricket flour, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a number of new companies across North America and the world, Europe and Asia, that are producing insect-based food products. So one that's become kind of popular is the cricket powder. So essentially a cricket flour or a high protein powder that you could put into anything that you're baking or a smoothie. You use it the same way you would use soy powder or soy protein or whey protein. And that's a really easy way to integrate insects into the diet if you're a little bit squeamish about facing the insect. And we in this field kind of joke that crickets are the gateway bug instead of the gateway drug. because they're an insect we're familiar with. We aren't as disgusted by them as we may be some other insects. We're comfortable with the idea of eating them as opposed to, you know, a ladybug that we might really love in a different way. So they help people, you know, get exposed to insects. And the powder, you know, I got my 7-year-old mom to eat muffins with cricket powder in it. It took a couple years to talk her into it, but now she's an avid consumer. And so that's a really easy way, you know, if you're not comfortable eating whole insects and facing the insect. But I will say that, you know, fresh insects prepared in culturally traditional ways are delicious. You know, there's these grasshoppers in Mexico called chapulines that are spiced, and you often can eat them warm, and they're kind of a street food with a chili lime flavor, and they're really good. here in the U.S., we mostly have access to dried insects. And it's really the difference between beef jerky and a steak sirloin, you know, like a dried product is really quite different. So I always encourage people that when they travel to a place where there is a strong culture of eating insects to try those traditional dishes, because it's just a really different experience.
I just want to get back to May here for a moment. I mean, we're talking here about crickets being a gateway. What insects have you explored eating, and what was your reaction, May?
So we have focused on growing at one specific species of insect, which is called the black soldier fly. And we picked this species both for its nutritional profile, so very rich in protein, but also very balanced protein profile. And also it has a lot of micronutrients that have health benefits that are antioxidant and antimicrobial. But we also picked it because it was very efficient to produce this specific species. More so, for instance, than crickets. I completely agree with Valerie on the gateway insect, because we are more familiar with crickets. But if we think of the future, there might be other species that are more efficient and sustainable to produce. So we've been using this black soldier fly for 6 years now and producing it at a very large scale. And we've tried it in several recipes. So we focused on three applications: protein bar, falafels, and snacks. And I liked the comment from Tom around how can we use it as a supplement, because I think in the United States, people have a very good education on nutritional food value. And so they think about calories, they think about what the food is going to bring to them. And I think this will be a great way to introduce insect into people's diets, because you won't only look at it from a taste perspective, but also what is this additional ingredient going to bring to me in terms of health, in terms of nutritional value. And so that's something we're working on as we build different recipes, including insect, which is, first of all, it needs to taste delicious, because no one wants to eat something yucky. But also, how do you make it kind of a superfood?
Can you go into a little bit further, May, as you produce black soldier flies, how is that process? How do you produce and harvest them? Can you give us some insight?
Absolutely. So as I said, we use byproduct of the agricultural industry. So here in the US, we'll use byproducts from the corn industry, and we co-locate our facilities with large corn mills. So in Decatur, we're partnering with ADM and using the byproducts from their process. These are completely natural products, but they will usually be considered as a waste stream. And so we can upcycle that waste stream. Our larvae feed on this feedstock for about a week. So it's a very short life cycle. And in that time span, they grow very fast, from, if you take the human equivalent, the size of a newborn to the size of a blue whale. So that's how fast they grow.
Wow.
And after a week, we'll harvest them, and our process is fully mechanical. So what we do is we dry them, and then we separate the protein part from the oil part, and we sell those as two separate ingredients that can go into different recipes, either for animal nutrition or for human nutrition. So it's a very short cycle and a very natural one. The challenge is really being able to do it at a very large scale if we want to have an impact on the environment and be able to become a mainstream ingredient.
Valerie, how might harvests work in other parts of the world?
Yeah, so about 92% or more of insects consumed by people around the world are collected from the wild. So people are foraging them and wild harvesting. And I've seen really innovative ways to do this. If you're collecting flying termites, for example, in Africa below the Sahara, you might hold up a light at night and the insects will swarm to your light and hit it and then fall into a bucket of water that you have set up. So you're collecting them in buckets of water overnight. With caterpillars, people are collecting them from trees by hand and then processing them and often sun drying them or roasting them in dry ash. And they're typically available during certain seasons. So you'll have seasons of abundance in terms of the collection and harvesting of wild insects around the world. But I do want to note that there is certainly in small-scale insect farming for human consumption around the world as well. In Thailand, I think there's more than 20,000 cricket farmers who do small-scale cricket farming for sale into local food markets for human consumption, kind of using very rudimentary farming equipment, buckets, bins built from wood or plastic or concrete, and kind of farming them also with short life cycles the way not as black soldier fly, but short life cycles and, you know, innovative mechanisms for farming and collecting them.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for the invitation. It was a great discussion.
Valerie Stoll, faculty associate, UW-Madison, with Mighty May Walraven, general manager of InnovaFeed North America. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As state lawmakers wrap up a floor period and send bills to Governor Tony Evers' desk, we get up to speed on legislation moving through the two houses with Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk. Call in with a question, share comments along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Anya, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So starting with the Brewers, the legislature approves a plan Tuesday to spend nearly $500 million to repair American Family Field over the next 3 decades, keeping the Brewers in Milwaukee. State and local taxpayer funding for the plan has been a point of contention. Where did the mix of funding sources ultimately land?
Yeah, there has been a lot of back and forth, but the final setup is that the state will pay about $387 million. The city and county of Milwaukee will pay a combined about $135 million, and then the team will pay $110 million. And then there was kind of a late change so that there's now going to be a ticket surcharge on non-Brewer events, so things like concerts, and that's going to start at $2 for most tickets and start at $8 for luxury box tickets.
Among in that back and forth, what came up as a place where you could see the bipartisanship at work, the collaboration? Was it the entry with the ticket surcharge? Where did the support ultimately coalesce?
Yeah, there was back and forth about the responsibility of the city and county of Milwaukee. The argument there was that, you know, they foot much of the bill, so they should have a little bit more say. And so they were able to get a couple members on the board that brought on some Democratic support. But there was actually bipartisan support and opposition. And so some of the bipartisan opposition was that there was not sufficient concessions from the team, from the Brewers themselves, alongside this kind of significant public funding. So we saw both sides kind of uniting on both sides of the issue.
Examining the team side, legislators opposing the plan, they worried the state has failed to secure enough insurances or concessions from the Brewers. What are the Brewers agreeing to in the plan?
Yeah, pretty simply, they are agreeing to stay put until 2050. But as you say, there was this pushback from some Republicans and Democrats saying that they should have gotten more. And one of the big criticisms is that, you know, there's no guarantee that they won't come back in X number of years and ask for more money. All this says is that they cannot relocate before 2050.
Republican State Senator Rob Coles of Green Bay voted against this plan, and Coles said he wants a review of the Brewers' finances by state auditors prior to authorizing the funding. How are supporters of the plan explaining their position given the financial resources of the Brewers and Major League Baseball?
Yeah, essentially they say, you know, this is an investment in a property that the state already owns and that they lease to this team, and so that there will be a return on that investment. So there's the income tax revenue from Brewers players and employees, sales tax revenue, obviously, from the stadium. They point to jobs that are generated by the stadium itself and that will be generated by these improvement plans. And so essentially they say that all of this will pay off and continues to pay off, that the Brewers are a major economic driver currently and will continue to be so.
Yes, those words, Governor Evers calling the plan and the Brewers a critical economic driver. The legislation would grow the board, as you mentioned, that oversees the stadium to 13 members. A majority of the board would be appointed by the governor. How significant is this change in the stadium's management?
Yeah, so that's actually another argument, right, that supporters of this plan make, is that the money doesn't go to the Brewers itself or to the, you know, quite wealthy owners, but to the baseball park district that manages the facility. And then they sign off on every taxpayer dollar that gets spent. And so there was a lot of back and forth about how that board is structured, and the kind of final makeup is that there are six people from appointed by the legislature, six appointed by the governor, and then one that is brought forward by the Brewers and then ultimately approved by the governor. And as I mentioned, two of the governor's picks would be brought to him by Milwaukee leaders. And so that's significant because the governor's picks would not have to be approved by the legislature. So especially in this very divided government that we live under, Republicans hold the legislature quite firmly, but this gives Democrats a little bit more power in Milwaukee, a little bit more power, obviously, as long as there is a Democratic governor.
You mentioned there was bipartisan negotiation here. We saw lawmakers actively talking and collaborating on this plan. Do you think that bodes well as we go forward?
I would love to be optimistic in that way. I will say this is one of the kind of rare moments when Democratic participation in a legislative process was actually critical to getting something over the finish line. I think many issues that come forward just don't have that type of, they're much more divided by party. And so I don't think most issues have that kind of impetus for bipartisan action. We will see, but this is sort of a, I think, more of a special circumstance than a sign that bipartisanship is on the rise here in Wisconsin.
We're talking about state politics after the legislature's last scheduled floor period of 2023, the fall floor period. Anya Van Wagtendonk, our guide, WPR's state capitol reporter. You can join in with your questions, your comments, the legislation you're watching along the way. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Anya, let's take a call now. Jack in Madison is here. Jack, what is your question?
Good morning. So I was overhearing you guys talk about American Family Field and the Brewers and the decision to keep them in Milwaukee for the long term. And I wondered what the role of ownership was. And I overheard Anya talking about how wealthy the Brewers owners are and just sort of what they've been doing or what they can do to keep the Brewers in Milwaukee to kind of take the pressure off the legislature and the Wisconsin taxpayer, if that makes sense.
Jack, thank you. What do the owners bring to the table, Anya?
Yeah, I mean, so this deal, you know, as I just mentioned, is more or less set. And Governor Evers, as you mentioned, is going to sign it. The owners never explicitly said that they were going to leave Milwaukee. And so there wasn't really that kind of explicit threat. But I think part of the narrative was that there were, you know, other cities that were interested. That's what some legislators have said. And so, and the Brewers are a very small market. And so I think that there was just some concern about wanting to kind of like sweeten the pot and, you know, guarantee that the baseball franchise stays in Milwaukee.
Jack, thanks for the question. Turning to gig workers now, Anya, Wisconsin gig workers would be designated as independent contractors under a proposal by Republican lawmakers. Pew Research estimating one in every six people have done gig work. What would the designation mean for workers and employers?
Yeah, so determining how to classify gig workers has been this ongoing debate for basically as long as these apps have been on our phones. This proposal would affect drivers specifically. So that's, you know, rideshare operators for Uber and Lyft, and then also drivers for delivery apps like DoorDash, Uber Eats, Instacart, things like that. And so essentially what this says is that those types of drivers are independent contractors, and that means that they can set their own hours, they can work for multiple competing apps, they can just sort of generally decide how and where and when to work. And then in exchange, they don't get certain benefits and protections that are for full-time employees, so like overtime pay, unemployment insurance, or workers' comp if they get hurt on the job.
Does that leave them exposed? What is in it for gig workers to have this designation?
Yeah, so critics of bills like this say that it does leave them exposed, that it allows them to be exploited, to sort of not have those, you know, kind of basic labor protections. What supporters say is that it gives them flexibility, that not every gig worker is a full-time gig worker, that it's something that people do on the side while they're going to school or working another job or in retirement for a little bit of part-time income. And so that taking away that flexibility would require a completely different kind of relationship to, let's say, picking up shifts on a Saturday from time to time, that kind of thing. And so it's about giving, they say it's about giving workers that flexibility.
And you note there is some discussion about a portable benefit account in this legislation. What would that do?
Yeah, that's a kind of interesting newer thing that's arising in this conversation, because so much of that push-pull is around things like health insurance, retirement benefits, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so this would basically be a standalone account that companies and workers could pay into according to certain eligibility standards that the worker could then pull out of for things like retirement benefits or health insurance or to take time off if they do need to recover from an illness or an injury, because they would not be getting those things, you know, the way a sort of traditional full-time employee would.
So classification of gig workers, this is a topic of debate here in Wisconsin, but also nationally, national policymakers working on this. Is the Wisconsin proposal in line with standards being considered by the federal government?
Yeah, so it's very much been a battle at the federal government. There were certain standards put in place under the Obama administration, and then during the Trump administration, those workers were considered independent contractors, as is being proposed here. Last year, the Biden administration attempted to roll that back in a certain way, so that Department of Labor kind of issued this proposed rule saying that they should be treated more like employees and have access to things like the minimum wage or a minimum wage protection over time, things like that. So the Wisconsin proposal obviously needs to follow federal fair labor standards. That's mm-hmm. how the law works. But the distinction is sort of around who is included in which portions of state and federal employment law. So it gets kind of thorny. But essentially, this bill seeks to define what a gig worker is here in Wisconsin and then set those state standards. And it's interesting. I mean, this is very clearly like a state by state strategy that these tech companies have. And so there were lobbyists who appeared remotely at a hearing recently, and they've been appearing at state legislature after state legislature. So I think this is, you know, clearly kind of part of that legislative strategy on their part.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR's State Capitol reporter. Our guide to helping us get up to speed on legislation advancing this floor period and headed to Governor Tony Evers' desk. You can join the discussion about bills. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the fall floor period comes to a close, we get takeaways. We track legislation with Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk. And you can be part of the discussion about the proposals you're following. Call in with a question. Share what's on your mind. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anya, looking at this workforce legislation, 2 months ago, Governor Evers calling a special session urging the legislature to pass workforce development measures. And then on Tuesday, Republican lawmakers advance their own version of a workforce bill. What stands out in this legislation?
Yeah, it's very focused on tax cuts and credits, which is a top priority of this Republican legislature. So there was a version of the tax cut that they had included in the state budget earlier this year and that Evers vetoed. And then a central theme of the Evers bill had been childcare. His proposal had been to put sort of money into the provider side of things through subsidies. And then the Republican version of addressing childcare was more of a tax credit-based system for some families. So there were some thematic similarities, but the approaches were very different. There were also a couple other priorities in there around changing professional credentialing processes and imposing new requirements on collecting unemployment insurance.
So how different are the measures backed by Democrats and the governor versus what Republicans want to do?
Yeah, it's night and day. Governor had, he'd asked for a paid family leave program, funding for a new engineering building at UW, a couple of other kind of spending programs like that. None of that was included. As I mentioned, Evers has already vetoed the tax cut. So there's basically no common ground between these two bills, which means that Evers is almost certainly going to just veto it. And we are back to square one.
When I looked at how different some of the things in this bill are from one another, I just thought, could some of these items have gotten through and signed if they were had been like standalone measures and not part of a larger bill?
That's a good question. I think some of the items that are in there, like the changes to the credentialing process that has been a subject of some, sort of actual conversations across party lines. So I think that's possible. Part of the Democratic criticism of the bill was that it just essentially wasn't serious, that it just didn't kind of engage with these concerns about, for example, childcare access in a kind of serious way, because Republicans knew that the governor was just going to veto it. So it is possible that some of these could get floated as standalone pieces of legislation. And we'll see. The tax cut was itself floated as a standalone piece of legislation. So it's certainly possible. But I think that this was kind of a way of, engaging with the special session bill, sending it to committee and going through that process, but then ultimately kind of requesting a very sort of different set of priorities.
Talking about state politics after the last scheduled floor period of 2023, Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR's state capitol reporter. You can join in with your questions and comments about legislation, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Sharon in Hales Corners. Sharon, hi. What's on your mind?
I'm curious about the status of legalizing cannabis in the state.
And are you looking at the medical cannabis or recreational? What specifically legislation are you following?
Both. I'm a medical patient myself and need to drive to Illinois. I know that Illinois is enjoying a lot of tax revenue that comes with primarily the recreational side, but I'm curious about the status of both recreational and medical in the state.
Sharon, thank you so much for the call. Anya, is there any movement on legalizing marijuana as you watch the legislature?
Yeah, so as I understand it, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who essentially sets the agenda, has made very clear that under his leadership, there will not be recreational marijuana in the state of Wisconsin. And so, as the caller mentions, every surrounding state around Wisconsin does have some form of legalized cannabis. Wisconsin currently is an island, and I think ongoingly will be sort of an island in that. There has been conversation, bipartisan conversation, around very, very limited medical usage. So Democrats kind of, as a party, and Governor Evers have said that they would like medical and recreational use. I think that most likely what we could expect is some kind of proposal around that limited medical usage, but nothing has been proposed this session. That's something to keep an eye on for when lawmakers come back in the new year.
Sharon, thanks for the call. Let's turn to elections. Lawmakers proposing a number of election and voting related bills this session, including related to processing absentee ballots and voting in assisted care facilities. What kind of changes are being proposed in election administration?
Yeah, there are almost a dozen on the table by my count, and that includes both bills and then constitutional amendments, which are things that will go before voters, some potentially as early as the spring. The biggest one, I think, might be allowing some clerks to start processing absentee ballots before Election Day. Currently, that process can't start until the morning of, which means that in cities like Milwaukee with larger populations, voting totals aren't often known until very late at night. And listeners may remember that that helped fuel conspiracy theories in 2020. Trump allies sort of accusing Milwaukee officials of dumping votes in the middle of the night when it was just sort of a question of not being able to process the huge number of absentee ballots in a timely fashion. Mm. So Governor Tony Evers has actually said that he would sign that proposal. And then there's other proposals around, for example, the distance between election observers and people counting ballots, a wide range of proposals on the table.
One proposal that passed the assembly waiting action by the Senate would change voting access for people in assisted care facilities. What is happening there?
Yeah, so that was another big challenge during the 2020 election. Special voting deputies get sent into nursing homes to help people who can't come out and vote in person. That process was suspended in 2020 because of COVID, and again, kind of led to some arguments that this allowed people who should not legally have been able to vote to cast ballots. Election officials contest that, especially sort of in the context of the 2020 measures, but reviews have found that some number of voters who have had their voting rights taken away for reasons of mental competency have cast ballots in the past. And there's not a really sort of centralized system for keeping track of those types of voters. So what this proposal would do is just alert families of people who live in those types of facilities when the special voting deputy is coming in. And the idea is, you know, families could sort of provide that check if they know that a loved one has sort of lost their voting rights for reasons of mental capacity, that's just sort of like a check on the system.
Okay, we'll be watching that one. In our last 30 seconds together, the legislature wrapping up the last scheduled floor period. When will lawmakers likely convene again?
They are scheduled to come back in mid-January.
And what do you suspect will be their agenda to address?
Yeah, great question. There's a couple of pieces of outstanding legislation that have passed one chamber but not the other. So I'm paying attention to things like PFAS, some education issues. There's this ongoing battle around diversity funding at UW campuses and a proposed raise for UW employees. And then I'm also curious how they'll be responding to some of the major cases that are coming before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, the Supreme Court as well in the litigation there, because it seems that the legislation and some Supreme Court issues certainly related. Anya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR's State Capitol reporter, and you can see more of Anya's reporting and State Capitol coverage at WPR.org. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.